Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
I think there have been times where I have said I've got to step up my game in terms of talking to the American people about issues like healthcare.
And so the president tried five times yesterday to step up his healthcare communications game with appearances on five Sunday talk shows everywhere but Fox. Now, did you ever wonder if five very competitive network news anchors all got to interview the president of the United States on the same day, how they would try to distinguish themselves in their opening questions? Here's how.
Senator Rockefeller, several other Democrats say that this bill by Senator Baucus is a big middle class tax increase. Do you agree, and does that mean you can't sign it?
Well, I don't agree.
I wonder whether you approach this with a minimum threshold of what you'll accept for reform, or at this point have you said, I've laid out my plan, take it all or nothing?
You know,
ask 20 people. What would you ask if you had the privilege that I have at this moment? 18 of the 20, 18 asked a variation of
jobs.
Where are the jobs? When are they coming back?
Yeah. Well, look,
I have a bridge to save you. Have you promised too much, Mr. President?
No, I don't think I've promised too much at all. Look.
¿Cuál es el problema? ¿Que el gobierno se está metiendo demasiado con los ciudadanos o que va a haber déficit de miles de millones de dólares? ¿Cuál es el problema?
Sí, sabes. Bueno, parte de esto es, yo creo que, sabes, la posición.
All right, five network news anchors. Chris Wallace didn't get a shot there. We'll ask if that made a difference and how the five network news anchors tried to distinguish themselves in beginning their interviews with the president. Of course, the president did this primarily because he did want to get the health care message across and fight for some version of a major health reform bill. But he was also distracted into making other news with the leaked reports that he has asked Governor Patterson not to run for re-election here in New York. We'll talk about that. And that General McChrystal in Afghanistan wants more troops or we're going to lose the war. And we'll talk about that. That, of course, is a really big deal. Afghanistan, that the country is only beginning to discuss, should we send tens of thousands more Americans to fight in Afghanistan? Remember the debate over President Bush's troop surge. We are only beginning to contemplate having that debate in the United States right now. But let's talk about all of it with Ron Brownstein, political director at Atlantic Media. He wrote a piece on the healthcare debate last week called What the Baucus Plan Got Right. Hi, Ron. Welcome back to WNYC.
Hey, good morning. Glad to be here.
Now, most Americans don't watch these Sunday talk shows. They sensibly leave it to people like you and me to mess up our weekends by channel surfing between Face the Nation and Meet the Press and then reporting on what we saw. So I'm kind of distressed this morning to see that the most media coverage seems to be of the exchange between the president and Stephanopoulos over whether the individual mandate to carry insurance is a tax. And we'll play some of it in a minute. But is that what the nation is seeing mostly from this five-show, two-language blitz?
You know, I thought there was kind of a hole in the strategy here, which for the White House, which kind of leads you to that kind of result. And not only that clip, but also his comments on Afghanistan to some extent overshadowing healthcare. And the problem is, Brian, he didn't really have any news that he wanted to commit on healthcare. He wanted to reaffirm his existing message. For instance, he did not go out and say, here are the three changes I want in the Baucus bill. If he went out and said, as the Senate Finance Committee begins to mark up this long-awaited bill this week, if he had gone out yesterday and said, okay, here's what I like about it, here are the four things that have to change in order for me to support it, that would have been the news everywhere this morning. But, you know, the media, like nature, abhors a vacuum. And since there was no real news on health care in terms of further delineating or articulating his position, the random questions that struck a nerve become the news on Monday morning. I mean, a news show is not a speech to the nation. It is a news show, and the press is going to focus on what was news in this, and frankly, his message on health care didn't really have any news in it.
So here's the exchange that everyone's talking about, but I'm disappointed in Stephanopoulos for imposing this distraction on this real complicated health care debate, and then I'm disappointed in everyone else for highlighting it so much. Stephanopoulos asks, isn't an individual mandate in effect a tax increase on those individuals who would be forced to pay for health insurance?
For us to say that you've got to take a responsibility to get health insurance is absolutely not a tax increase. What it's saying is that we're not going to have other people carrying your burdens for you any more than the fact that right now everybody in America just about has to get auto insurance. Nobody considers that a tax increase. People say to themselves, that is a fair way to make sure that if you hit my car, that I'm not covering all the costs.
But it may be fair. It may be good public policy.
No, but George, you can't just make up that language and decide that that's called a tax increase. Any more, if I say that right now your premiums are going to be going up by 5 or 8 or 10% next year, and you say, well, that's not a tax increase. But on the other hand, if I say that I don't want to have to pay for you not carrying coverage, even after I give you tax credits that make it affordable, then...
I don't think I'm making it up. Merriam-Webster's dictionary. Tax, a charge usually of money imposed by authority on persons or property for public purposes.
George, the fact that you looked up Merriam's dictionary, the definition of tax increase, indicates to me that you're stretching a little bit right now. Otherwise, you wouldn't have gone to the dictionary to check on the definition.
Well, no.
I mean, if what you're saying
is... I wanted to check for myself, but your critics say it is a tax increase.
My critics say everything's a tax increase.
All right, Ron Brownstein.
That was a good ending.
That was a good ending. That was a really good ending. Does the question being raised in that exchange, the fact that Stephanopoulos came armed with the Merriam-Webster definition of tax, does it matter whether you define it as a tax increase, or is this just a distraction from the real substance
of
the issue?
Well, no, but there is a substantive issue, I mean, underneath. I mean, you are going to be requiring people to commit some of their own resources. But at the same time, most of them are going to be receiving a substantial government subsidy. The president analogized it to requiring people to buy auto insurance. But this is even a little different than that, in the sense that almost everyone who is uninsured now, I mean, the vast majority of people are uninsured now, who would be required to reach into their own pocket to pay part of the cost of insurance under an individual mandate, will be receiving substantial government help to do so. I was thinking, as you were playing the clip, would people think cash for clunkers was a tax increase? Because the only way they could get the cash for clunkers tax break from the government was to commit some of their own money to buying the car. I mean, by that logic, cash for clunkers is a tax increase, because you have to, you know, to trigger the government assistance, you have to use some of your own money.
Right.
Look, there is, though, an underlying issue, and it is raised very pointedly by the Baucus bill. Whatever you want to call it, under an individual mandate, which I believe does make a lot of sense because it is the key to the fundamental insurance reform that is really important here. Under an individual mandate, there are people who have chosen not to buy health insurance today who are going to have to reach into their own pocket to do so. And the question is that obligation going to be onerous or affordable? And one of the, I think, most persuasive critiques of the bill that Max Baucus came up with, which I think has a lot of positive things in it, is that he doesn't do enough to make health care affordable for people in the middle class, especially in that $50,000 to $80,000 range. And certainly that is a recipe for a backlash. If you're going to require people to buy insurance and then you're going to ask them to pay an unrealistic share of their income toward doing that, I think the country is going to be upset with that, whatever you call it. So that's one of the areas where the Baucus bill is likely to be changed substantially this week to make those subsidies more affordable. And, of course, that raises the cost and increases the need to find offsets to pay for the bill. So whatever you call it, there is an issue there. I don't think I would call it a tax, but there is a real issue of affordability in what you're asking people to contribute.
And so here's another exchange from that same show that I think was a little more substantive, right along the lines you were just describing, on whether the Baucus plan provides enough subsidies to middle-class Americans to make individual insurance policies affordable. And this is Stephanopoulos again asking the question. Again, he frames it in terms of a tax, but the context is very different here, and listen to the president's response.
This week, Senator Rockefeller, several other Democrats, say that this bill by Senator Baucus is a big middle-class tax increase. Do you agree, and does that mean you can't sign it?
Well, I don't agree. I think that what they were referring to, and I haven't looked at the quotes, but I think they were concerned about whether or not this was actually affordable. If you're saying to people you got to get health insurance, but they can't actually afford it, and they have to pay a penalty if they don't get it, then that's a pretty big burden on middle-class families. That's a concern I share, making sure that this is affordable. But the first thing we got to understand is you've got what is effectively a tax increase taking place on American families right now. The Kaiser Family Foundation report just came out last week. Healthcare premiums went up 5.5% last year at a time when the rest of the economy, inflation was actually negative. So that is a huge bite out of people's pockets. And part of what I've been trying to say throughout this campaign, effort to get healthcare done, is that if we don't do anything, guaranteed, Americans' costs are going to go up, more people are going to lose healthcare coverage, the insurance companies are going to continue to prevent people from getting it for pre-existing conditions. Those are all burdens on people who have health insurance right now.
That is true.
And so
President Obama with George Stephanopoulos on ABC this week, yesterday, one of five Sunday talk shows he appeared on. We're talking about the President's Blitz with Ron Brownstein, political director at Atlantic Media, which includes Atlantic Magazine and National Journal, and some other things.
Ron, many other things.
Many other things. The problem that Jay Rockefeller had with the Baucus plan, and I don't think Stephanopoulos communicated it in the way you did before the clip, is from the left, not the conservative tilt that Stephanopoulos implies by framing the question in terms of taxes. Jay Rockefeller thinks the Baucus plan spends too little federal money on subsidizing individuals who have to buy health coverage under the mandate and spends too little on Medicaid, shifting that burden to the states for the extra people who'd be covered that way. Isn't that true?
Well, that is his concern. And in fact, I think it's not only on the left. I mean, I think there's pretty broad consensus. And even Baucus has acknowledged that the subsidies are going to have to be adjusted. The Senate bill over the next decade spends about $300 billion less than the House bill on subsidizing middle-class families to buy insurance. Middle-class families would be required to buy insurance through the mandate. So obviously, there's a major difference there. I don't think people expect it to get all the way up to the level of the House bill, but there's no question that the Senate bill will be adjusted. Although, you know, as I said in my piece on Friday, there are aspects of the Baucus bill that are, I think, important to advancing this overall goal. In particular, the extent to which it embodies long-term structural reform in the healthcare system and in the Medicare payment system, moving away from a fee-for-service system on many fronts toward a system that will reward providers based on outcomes, not just inputs. You know, there was a Freudian slip in the president's answer there when he talked about the campaign at one point in this campaign. Because during the campaign, as you recall, Brian, he opposed an individual mandate precisely for this reason, that he thought it was unrealistic to ask people to buy insurance they couldn't afford. So that is an issue he's very sensitive to, and I suspect one where we'll see substantial movement in the Senate Finance Committee, if not quite as far as the House version has gone.
And he came to agree ultimately with Hillary Clinton that you need the individual mandate to get younger, healthier people to buy into the insurance system, to put enough money in the system from people who aren't going to take so much out, so that there would be more in there for the older, sicker people who are going to need it, correct?
As they say on another radio show, ditto. I mean, that's exactly right. You know, one way to look at the individual mandate is, you know, some people describe it as a cross-generational subsidy, where we ask young people to come into the system and buy health insurance they don't really need to reduce the cost for older people. I look at it as a subsidy or a transfer over the course of your own life, really. If you think about it this way, the individual mandate means that everybody will be in the risk pool. And the result of that is that, yes, young people may pay, and especially if you have what's called a community rating that limits the differential between how much you can charge young people and old people, the effect of that would be that you pay more in your 20s and 30s than you might have otherwise for insurance, but you are going to pay less in your 40s and 50s for insurance than you would have otherwise, because there'll be future generations of young people themselves entering into the system. It really isn't a cross-generational subsidy. It's a way of changing the allocation of the cost over your own life, and really in that way is the essence of social insurance, and I think a very defensible policy on those grounds.
But here is Susie in the Bronx who says, oh, don't compare this to the mandate to have car insurance if you own a car. Susie, why not?
Well, I mean, frankly, you cannot drive, and most of the people in New York don't drive. You don't have the option, well, you have the option of not living, and that seems to be what they're offering. This is making being poor and broke illegal. I mean, this is crazy. This is completely crazy. The single-payer health care system would prevent every problem they are confronted with, and they won't even look at it. This is, they're putting a mandate on employers, which is going to mean higher unemployment at a time of awful unemployment. They're putting a mandate on people who can't afford to pay what they're paying for everything now, rent, food, whatever. And they're shoveling 45 million people into the maw of this hideous healthcare industry without even offering a public option. This is nothing but another giveaway to huge industry when we all know what the solution is. It is awful. I mean, think about it. Every civilized country has a single-payer system. This is not by accident.
Susie, thank you. So, what would the president say to Susie Rund-Brownstein?
I thought Susie is really encapsulates the fundamental political problem facing the advocates of health care reform, which is that if you have been out in the country, as I have in August, there's a lot of passion on the right about stopping this. Who view any step along the lines that the president is talking about, even an individual mandate and moving people into the private insurance system that Susie sees as a giant giveaway, they see all of that as a slippery slope to socialism. On the other hand, on the other side, the shock truth groups of the left view it as kind of mushy incrementalism that isn't worth fighting for and, in fact, should be, you know, Buffy the Vampire Slayer killed with a stake. And so you have this enormous imbalance right now in enthusiasm where the right is desperate to stop this and mobilizing very much to do so. And the left is kind of like sitting out saying it's not good enough. I just think that it's, that is a very dangerous posture to take for the kind of the ideological vanguard of the Democratic Party. Whatever the other merits of single payer, it does not have the merit of being politically viable. There's an interesting study came out last week from the Project on International Policy Attitudes in the University of Maryland. It was a global study of attitudes toward government in countries all over the world. And the U.S. is different. There is just much more suspicion of government power. It's kind of bred in our genes in big parts of the country, in red America. And it's a reality. And so the president is in a situation where he's having trouble generating as much activity on his side as the opponents can because the most ardent liberal elements of the Democratic Party don't see this is much worth fighting for, but I can tell you the conservatives certainly see it as something worth killing.
Right. And so you predicted in your What the Baucus Plan Got Right article that by introducing a bill that cuts the deficit, and the Congressional Budget Office actually scored this better than Baucus scored it itself. He said it would be deficit neutral. They said, no, this would cut the deficit. Baucus could get Republicans to go along, you said. But listen to Senator Orrin Hatch.
I don't think I said he could get Republicans to go along. What he could do is he could unify Democrats, but go ahead.
All right. So I'm sorry if I misunderstood, but listen to Senator Orrin Hatch of Utah last week on that very point of the Congressional Budget Office positive scoring of this bill.
You know, if anyone believes that Washington can do a plan that will cost close to $1 trillion, cover all Americans, not raise taxes on anyone, not increase the deficit, then I have a special bridge to sell to you.
So, Ron Brownstein, yeah. I remember when the original version of the House bills came out and the Congressional Budget Office said, oh, this is going to cost so much more. This is going to be a budget buster. This is going to increase the deficit. And the Republicans stood up and said, hey, that's the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office speaking. This bill must be bad. Now the same Congressional Budget Office says this bill would reduce the deficit, and suddenly Orrin Hatch doesn't trust their judgment.
No, absolutely. And look, Lindsey Graham yesterday on Meet the Press was asked about my column and said, well, the problem is they're never going to do any of the things that CBO is assuming they're going to do. So, talk about moving the goalposts. I mean, if you simply say, well, you know, we can't, they are not going to support this bill. We are moving toward a parliamentary, as I've written in my National Journal column, we are increasingly living in a parliamentary country where on big issues, the overwhelming pressure is on particularly the opposition party to unify against whatever the majority party wants to do. We're looking at a universe now of potential Republicans, probably of Olympia Snowe and maybe Susan Collins and possibly one other, but unlikely. And so the real issue here is, can you unify Democrats? And what I think some of the liberal critics like Howard Dean, who has been really hyperventilating about the Baucus bill, has missed. Yes, there are big flaws in it. It needs bigger subsidies for middle-class families. It needs a more sensible and larger contribution from employers. And the two of those things could help solve each other in that you could raise some of the revenue for the subsidies. But it does provide a foundation on which a broad range of Democrats may feel comfortable. You know, you have 22 Democratic senators from states that voted Republican in at least two out of the last three elections, if not three out of the last three elections. And they need to be able to go home and say they are dealing with this problem in a fiscally responsible manner. The Baucus bill has two big strengths. It embodies almost all of the best thinking of healthcare reformers about how to, quote, bend the curve over the long term by shifting the incentives for providers. And second, it does provide a fiscally sustainable framework with, as you know, the Congressional Budget Office saying that in its second decade, it reduces the deficit by half a point of GDP. The final bill probably won't go that far because, as I said, it has to spend more on subsidies. But there is a foundation here that a broad range of Democrats may be able to embrace. And I think it is very myopic for the left to kind of go after this with guns blazing because it is. This is the back end of this bill. The facade doesn't look so good, and there's some holes in the windows. But the foundation of it, the fiscal foundation, is very solid and one that makes it possible to bring in more of those red state Democrats who might otherwise say, "I can't afford to, you know, be for this."
We have a few minutes left with Ron Brownstein from The Atlantic and National Journal, the Atlantic Media Group. He's political director. And before we run out of time, the lead story in the Sunday New York Times was not about health care.
Yes.
Not about the president in Afghanistan. Not even about the president staking out new support for the Patriot Act, which he did very quietly the other day and which will be our next segment. But the president has sent a request to New York Governor David Paterson that Paterson not run for re-election next year, and that was the lead story in yesterday's Times.
Yeah.
It has three anonymous sources. Two it calls senior administration officials, plus one New York Democratic operative, which it says, or who it says, has direct knowledge of the situation. The governor did not quite even deny it when asked by a reporter yesterday. Listen to this clip.
I have said time and time again that I am running for governor next year. I am not going to discuss confidential conversations.
I'm not going to discuss confidential conversations, which means some kind of confidential conversation was had about this topic. Do you believe this story, and why is the White House getting involved?
My instinct is to believe the story for two reasons. One is that it reflects the obvious, that David Paterson is a very damaged incumbent who would have extraordinary difficulty holding the governorship of New York just before redistricting. That is a big deal for Democrats. Second, the White House has been very aggressive about intervening in primaries already. I mean, they endorsed Michael Bennett the other day in Colorado just before he is the appointed senator to replace Ken Salazar, just before Andrew Romanoff, the former Speaker of the State House, a very able politician, announced the primary challenge. They've done the same thing, of course, in Pennsylvania with Arlen Specter facing a primary challenge from Joe Sestak. So this is in their, modus operandi. I mean, they are willing to intervene, so it's totally plausible. And I think there are certainly a lot of Democrats in New York who assume that when you get to 2010, the name on the ballot for governor will not be David Paterson one way or the other.
But why, again, you mentioned redistricting. Maybe that's what we should dig in on for a minute or two. I guess since the New York State Legislature gets to draw the districts for Congress, and those districts can be drawn to the advantage of Democrats or Republicans, the president is afraid that if a weak Democrat is nominated for governor, he's presuming David Paterson is weak, that would let Rudy Giuliani be elected governor and more Republicans get elected to the state legislature, thereby winding up in more Republican congressional districts. Is that where we have to take this?
Or I don't really know how redistricting in New York State works. I should, even though I grew up there. But I assume the governor can veto the plan. And if you have in most states, at least, that's the way it works. And if you have a Republican governor who can veto the plan, then the Democrats, cannot draw as favorable a map. I don't know if that's their rationale. But it is at least one plausible rationale. I have not had any conversations with anybody about this. What I'm saying is, though, the more important pattern is they have shown themselves willing to intervene in this way. And I'm not sure what really motivated them to do so. There are a lot of reasons why you would worry about losing the governorship of New York. It is not exactly a unique view to the White House that David Paterson would have an extraordinarily hard time holding that seat. I mean, I think that's a pretty broadly accepted view among Democrats, everywhere.
So it's realpolitik. Is that the reason that they're endorsing Republican-turned-Democrat Arlen Specter in Pennsylvania over the progressive Democrat Congressman Joe Sestak, because they're more afraid Sestak would lose to a Republican in the general election?
Specter, I think, is a question of ensuring Specter's support in health care. I mean, I've always felt that was the play there.
Uh-huh. All right. And one other thing. When you start down this slippery slope, you're going to get blowback. Here is a sarcastic reaction to the president getting involved in the governor's race from State Senator Ruben Diaz of the Bronx. As quoted by the Barrero Report today, Diaz, a Democrat, says, "I deeply appreciate President Barack Obama's concern for the future of the New York Democratic Party and the importance of maintaining a Democrat for governor of New York State. I am hopeful that President Obama will now show the same initiative by supporting and strongly campaigning for Democratic mayoral candidate William Thompson. This way, President Obama will show that his concern for the Democratic Party in New York State is unquestionable." So, big sarcastic tone there. Any reaction real quick to that or to the idea that the president has not endorsed Thompson over Michael Bloomberg?
The success of presidents at disciplining their parties through the primary process, going back to Franklin Roosevelt in 1938 with the Southern Dixiecrats, is very limited. It's very difficult to do. And as you say, you do get a lot of blowback. White Houses like to do it. Certainly Karl Rove is very aggressive in doing so. I'm a little surprised the Obama people with kind of their grassroots bottom-up ethos have been so aggressive, but they are what they are. And the pattern is clear. I mean, this is not the first time they have tried to put their thumb on the scale or more than that. So I think it is something that they are going to pursue unless, as you know, what you just quoted, they get enough blowback and it becomes more problem than it's worth.
Ron Brownstein, political director at Atlantic Media. Thank you so much.
Hey, thank you.
Brian Lehrer on WNYC. And coming up in a minute, we will look at the president's change of position on the Patriot Act. Stay with us.